every summer to be together, and although we certainly saw each other plenty throughout the rest of the year, I always looked forward to it. Only this year I knew things were going to be different. I had received a phone call from James earlier in the week, which was kind of odd. I was scared something was wrong, so I ran out of the gift shop where I was working, saying, "I'm so sorry, I have to take this." "Sloan," he had said, his northern accent a bit of a shock after being surrounded by so many southern voices. "I think I may need your help." His accent saying that was really a shock. "Are you guys okay? Is Caroline okay?" "Not really," he said, and I felt my stomach clench. "Sloan, she is obsessed with having another baby. It's all she can think about, and I'm really worried about her." I knew Caroline was getting ready to try in vitro again, and I knew she was consumed by this quest, but I reasoned that anybody would be. 2 days later, I saw for myself exactly what James had been worried about. Caroline had talked about nothing but babies and pregnancy since we arrived. Ironically, Caroline was the one who had always been best at talking sense into people. It wasn't my forte, but I was going to try. I waited until the two of us were alone in the kitchen. "I'm going to have some of my fertility tea," she said, getting up from the island and walking to the stove. Then she turned back to me. "Hey," she said, "do you want some?" I smiled. She was sneaky. "You know I don't want children," I said. She shook her head. "No, Sloan, it's not that you don't want children. You're scared to have children." "And?" "And there's a huge difference." She filled up the teapot and turned on the burner. She leaned against the counter and said, "I'm scared, too. I'm terrified. I'm terrified every day that Vivi is in the world that something horrible might happen to her." "So why do you want to do it again?" I asked. She leaned over the island toward me. "Because, Sloan, one moment of your child being on Earth is worth millions of years of worry. There's no way to explain how magical it is to bring another life into the world, how soul-satisfying it is to be someone's mother." If I was honest, I had started wondering lately if I could do it, if I could put aside my fear and trust enough to give my husband the thing he wanted most in the world, the thing that loomed between us every time we made love. "It's scary as hell," Caroline said. "In fact, I'd venture to say it's the scariest thing you'll ever do." As the kettle began to sing, Caroline added, "But I swear to you, Sloan, once you have a child, you'll feel like your life before was black and white, and now everything is in color." I realized that night I hadn't done a thing to convince my sister to give up her fertility project. In fact, quite the opposite. She had convinced me to take up a fertility project of my own. I woke Adam up. He smiled at me sleepily. "What's shaking, sugar?" I had had my IUD removed years before, and I was holding my birth control pills in my hand. Adam closed one eye and looked at me.
"What are you doing with that?"
"I'm throwing it away."
"Is it bad or something?" he asked.
I shook my head. "It's not bad," I said. "It's just that I think we should have a baby." Adam shot up in bed and looked around.
"Is this real? Am I dreaming?"
I kissed him softly and laughed.
"You're not dreaming. I've been thinking about it for a few months now. I don't think I was ready before."
He nodded and pulled me to him.
"You are going to be the best mother in the world, and I promise you I will do everything I can to ease your fear."
"You already have," I said. And I knew, as he pulled me on top of him, that it was true. It might have been Caroline who pushed me over the edge, but it was Adam, with his patience, love, and care every single day, who had made me trust again. And nothing in this world, nothing in my entire life, made me happier than to repay him for that gift.
36. Our Truth. Ansley. It seemed fitting that Carter would find out the truth about Caroline and Sloane's father in Peachtree Bluff, on that boardwalk where we shared our first kiss, against the backdrop of a pink and blue cotton candy sky. I never really expected, in my heart of hearts, that I could go a lifetime without Carter finding out who Caroline and Sloane's biological father was. But I assumed eventually he would insist I tell him. It never occurred to me that we would pass Jack on the dock in Peachtree Bluff, that he would be completely shocked by my Emerson-pregnant belly, and that in that look he gave me, in the simplicity and nothingness of that moment, the secret we had kept for years and years would be revealed. When Carter ran away from me that afternoon, I didn't run after him. I knew better. Instead, I took the time to truly thank the man who had given me my family. Things were different between Jack and me that day. The heat between us had cooled some, as it tends to when separated by time and distance, and a good dose of grown-up rationality. But I still felt nervous standing beside him, my face flushed and my heart beating a little too fast. It was only as I walked away from Jack, as I felt that familiar piercing pain around my heart, that it occurred to me how long I had had that feeling. Part of me wanted to go back to him, but I had finally gotten to a place where I knew I had done the right thing. I had finally begun to feel like my life was playing out as it should. Sure, I would be happy for that moment with Jack, but that moment would only lead to months of heartache. There was no question I had done the right thing. No question, that is, until I got back to the house 2 hours later. When I found Carter, he was pacing the length of our bedroom. "Glad you two had time for a quick tryst for old time's sake," he said. I rolled my eyes. "Carter, come on, don't be ridiculous. If I had thought I was nervous with Jack on the dock, it was nothing compared to now. It wasn't that I thought Carter would leave me, but it was one of the first times in our relationship that I was truly at a loss for what to do. I didn't know how to make him feel better, or how to make this right. The indignant part of me wanted to yell, "You did this! It was your idea! You created this situation to begin with!" It made me realize I still carried anger at him for placing this huge burden onto me. I sat down on the edge of the bed, placing my hands protectively over Emerson in my belly. Carter took a deep breath and said, "I have never felt so stupid in my entire life. Jack? Really, Ansley? The guy was Jack?" I sighed. "So would it be better if it were our yard man, Carter? Maybe the plumber? Maybe one of my friend's husbands? If it were someone you saw every week, would that make you feel better?" I crossed my arms, resting them on my barely protruding belly. This was going to be terrible no matter what, Carter. Any way we did this, it was going to be awful. So I'm sorry, but I thought Jack was the best choice. I trust him. He doesn't want kids. It made sense. "You trust him?" Carter practically spat, still pacing. I felt anger well in me. "So what did you think, Carter? What was your best-case scenario here? How was this ever going to be anything but awful?" What he said next knocked the wind out of me. It is a moment I will never forget, one of those moments where a new truth washed over me so completely it was as if I'd been immersed in water. But instead of feeling cleansed, I felt tainted and dirty. Carter stopped pacing, looked directly at me, and said, "I never thought you would do it." I sat there for a long moment, my mouth hanging open in shock. "You were adamant that we wouldn't adopt. You didn't want me to do IUI again. What choice did you leave me?" he shrugged. I figured we wouldn't have kids. He sighed. I knew you weren't with Jack because he didn't want kids, so I knew I couldn't say I didn't want them. I figured you would realize there were no good options and we would go along, just the two of us, no harm, no foul. It was like being punched in the gut. He started pacing again. I swear, Ansley, for a long time I actually thought Caroline might really be mine. I honestly did, because I couldn't imagine you would have had it in you to get pregnant by anyone else. He laughed incredulously then. I felt sick. It was one of those moments, one that I think most people have at least once during the course of a long marriage, where I realized I didn't know this man at all. Or maybe it was myself I didn't know. Because beneath my anger and shock at what he was saying was the question of what my motivation had been. I had ascribed the blame for this situation to Carter for all these years, and now I had to wonder if maybe all that blame should really be put on me. I was the one who went to Jack. I was the one who fell back in love with him. I was the one who risked my marriage for children. It was the first time I wondered if Carter and I could possibly make it through this. After all we had done to hurt each other, did we even stand a chance? I put my head in my hands, trying to come to grips with what Carter had just said to me. Then I looked up. So why did you ask me to do it again? A second time? He shrugged. At that point, I figured Caroline needed a sibling. We'd made it through once, we'd make it through again. And now? I asked, my throat thick with tears. That was when I finally felt him soften. He sat down beside me. And now we have another baby, one who is finally ours. I hate that Caroline and Sloane aren't mine, Ansley, I really do. But I don't love them any less because of it.
So it's just me you love less, I said, tears streaming down my cheeks.
He didn't answer, which was not exactly the response I was looking for. Seeing the pained expression on his face broke something inside me. I knelt down in front of him and took his face in my hands. I want you to hear me when I say this, Carter. You are the one. You have always been the one. Our lives may not have unraveled as perfectly as we had imagined, but I have never, not for one day, lost sight of the fact that you are the man I was meant to be with. There is no one, and I do mean no one, I would rather share this life with. You are my home, Carter. I never want to live without you. He took my hands and said, Get up off the floor, Ansley. You're too beautiful for the floor. When he held me to him, I knew it was going to be okay. I was still hugging him, resting my head on his shoulder, when Carter sighed and said, Do you love him? I could tell by the way he asked it, so quickly and breathily, that he was terrified to learn the answer. I could have said, A part of me will always love Jack. He gave us our girls. The truth was that I had loved him all day, every day, for most of my life, and I knew that would never end, no matter how much I wished it would. But despite that fact, I loved Carter more. I loved my family more. I didn't like lying to Carter. I never had. In some ways, I felt relieved that I didn't have this huge secret weighing on me anymore. But I knew better than to push it. So I said, looking out over my husband's shoulder, Of course not, Carter. I only love you. It was another lie. Maybe only the third one I had ever told my husband. I pulled away from him then, and he said, I'm so sorry, Ansley. I shouldn't have said that to you. I never wanted to say that to you.
So it's true, then? You weren't just angry? You really never expected me to get pregnant?
I saw the pause in his expression, the way he took a moment to think before he answered, like I had only seconds before. He hugged me to him again and said, "Of course that's not true. I was upset, so I took it out on you. This was the plan. You followed through. End of story." But he couldn't look me in the eye when he said it. It was the second lie we had told each other in as many minutes. But even though I knew he wasn't telling the truth, his little lie appeased me, just like I'm sure mine had him. Maybe it should have worried me, but it made me feel better. We were both willing to put aside a piece of our truth, a piece of ourselves, to make the other one feel better. And every now and then, I believe, that's what real love, the down and dirty in the trenches kind, is all about. I had never been so grateful for James. He was going to let us use his NetJet hours to take Sloane home the next day. I remembered going to visit Sloane on post when Adam was first stationed in North Carolina, decorating her little blue townhouse and trying to make it feel as comfortable and restful as possible. She had scolded me when we passed the row of stately historic officers' homes, because I had said, "When do I get to decorate one of those for you?" Adam had laughed. But later Sloane had said, "I don't ever want to make him feel like what he does or where we are isn't good enough." I had only been joking, but I felt badly and hoped I hadn't hurt Adam's feelings. I truly hadn't meant to. I admired how he was working his way up with patience and determination. As a mea culpa, I had a set of antique linen hand towels embroidered for Sloane. "Home is where the army sends us," they read. Where would home be for Sloane now? Emerson, Caroline, and I packed her bags. We all knew it would be a sleepless night. This was the moment we had all dreaded over the past months. It was the moment we had wanted to prepare Sloane for, the moment she simply would not accept as a possibility. I realized now it didn't matter whether she had prepared herself. It would have been impossible to face no matter what. Jack was making phone calls, sending emails, getting in touch with every politician, military figure, reporter, or investigator he had ever met. But there wasn't anything he could do. There wasn't anything anyone could do. Still, the fact that he was trying told me everything I would ever need to know. I was leaning against the kitchen counter, and Caroline, Emerson, and I were all looking at each other, numb. "What do I do?" I asked. "We take her home," Caroline said. "We'll get through this." In that moment, my phone rang. "Oh, my God," I said, my voice catching in my throat. "It's Scott." I looked at the phone, frozen. "Well, for God's sake, answer it," Caroline said. But it was Emerson who grabbed it. "Scott," she said. "Uh-huh." "No. You're kidding me." "Uh-huh." We were looking at her, gesturing for her to fill us in, but she put her finger in her ear and waved us away. "Oh, my God, Scott, I can't believe it." Was it a good "I can't believe it" or a bad one? There was no way to tell. It felt like hours, but I'm sure the phone call was less than 2 minutes. Then I heard Sloane's phone ring, then Jack's. And before Emerson could relay to us what Scott had said, Sloane flew out, wide-eyed, holding her phone. "They found him!" she screamed in a state that could only be described as manic. At first I thought she meant his body. We all stood motionless, afraid of what was going to happen next. "They found him! They found Adam! He's alive!" She crouched down on the floor and started sobbing into her knees. "He's coming home! Adam is coming home!" I wasn't sure I believed her. But I looked at Emerson, and her nod through her own tears confirmed what Sloane had said. It was as if 1,000 pounds I had carried around for months was lifted off me. I felt myself slide down the wall until I was sitting on the floor, face in my hands, crying.
"Look at my texts," she said. "I have a picture." "Oh, my God," Caroline screamed. "It's him. It's Adam." She turned the phone to the side. "He's so damn thin."
"Of course he's thin," Sloane said. "He's a freaking prisoner of war."
She stood up with purpose.
"Oh, my God, Scott is my favorite family member."
"Scott is my favorite family member, too," I exclaimed. Sloane looked around. She started sobbing with pure, utter relief.
"I have to get to D.C. right now," she said. "They're bringing him to Walter Reed, and I have to be there."
"Back up," Caroline said. "When will he be there?" Sloane crossed her arms.
"Well, they're taking him to Lonstool for triage, and then..."
"What on earth is Lonstool?" Emerson asked.
"The hospital in Germany," Sloane said impatiently, raising her voice.
"Do you want to go there?" I asked, trying to be helpful. Sloane sighed.
"They offered to fly me there, but by the time I get there, he'll probably be leaving. This makes the most sense."
We all stood there, silent and processing. Was this actually happening? No one moved. Sloane clapped her hands and said,
"Now!"
3 hours later, Sloane was kissing the boys goodbye inside the jet, with her bag slung over her shoulder.
"Be so good for Gransley," she said. Then she grinned. "I'm going to get Daddy."
There was a part of me that was worried she was meeting Adam at the hospital, and a part of me that wondered what that meant for him, for my daughter, and for their future. Even still, those might have been the sweetest words I had ever heard.
37. The Meaning of Life. Sloane. July 18th, 2017.
Dear Sloane, I'm coming home to you. Wow, I didn't think I would ever see your face again, or kiss my boys, throw a ball with them, feel your soft body snuggled up next to mine at night. I'm weak and exhausted. My leg and a few of my ribs were badly broken in the crash, and my shoulder was dislocated. Of course, I've had no medical care, so there's work to do. But I can't comprehend how lucky I am to be alive. We lost one of our men here, and I'm not sure I will ever be able to come to terms with the fact that I made it while he did not. How can that be? I'm rambling now when all I want to say is this. Sloane, you got me through these months. The thought of you, the memory of you, the warmth and the love of you is what pushed me forward when it would have been so much easier to succumb to the death that was so close I could almost feel it. I live for you, Sloane. I would die for you and everything in between. And now I get to see you again. Words do not exist to describe how much I have missed you, how I have longed for you in the darkest, deepest parts of me. I should warn you that once I come home to you, I may never leave your side again. Counting down the moments, my beautiful wife, until I am in your arms again. Until then, I am faithfully, lovingly, eternally, always and forever yours. Adam.
Holding Taylor in my arms for the first time was the last time I'd had this feeling that everything in my life had changed. Like everything I had believed to be true was insignificant compared to this moment. To think I had lost my true love only to find him again, it was nothing short of rebirth. I'd looked at my watch every 3 minutes for the past few days, willing the time forward. I'd gotten to Skype Adam and hear his voice, proving to myself he was alive. And now, every ounce of me was buzzing with the pure thrill and unbridled joy that I would get to touch him, kiss him, and hold him close to me once again. I was standing on the runway at Joint Base Andrews. Normally, I might have been excited to see Air Force One or been making small talk with Major Austin, the rear detachment commander who had kept me abreast of everything for the past few months, but I couldn't. I'd never felt this level of anxious excitement. A C-17 Nightingale flight would be bringing my husband from Landstuhl and landing right here in a matter of moments. I would get to ride an ambulance with him to Walter Reed, where he would be having surgery and receiving treatment before I could take him home for good. This was the moment I had envisioned for all those long, painful weeks, and now it was here. As the jet came into view, I had the sickening feeling it was coming in too quickly, but I should have known better. As it landed, blowing everything in its path, including my hair and the cream sundress Caroline had let me borrow, I squinted to keep the debris out of my eyes, but wouldn't dare close them all the way. I would get the first glimpse of Adam. When I saw the door open, I started running. There he was. My husband. My world. Everything I wanted and needed. He was in his combat uniform and boots, his arm in a sling and a cane in his hand. I ran to him, my tears nearly blinding me. I threw my arms around him. He threw his one good arm around me, and I kissed him like I'd never stop. He might have been pick-thin and badly wounded, but he was still Adam. He was still that strong, confident man I had fallen in love with in line at the post office. I could feel my tears and his tears mingling together like ingredients in a saucepan, could taste them between our kisses. I wrapped my arms around his middle so tightly he groaned, which is when I remembered his broken ribs. Poor guy. "Sorry," I said. But he smiled at me. "I don't care," he whispered into my ear. "You're here, Sloane. I'm here. We're together." I barely remember the ambulance ride or entering Walter Reed. I know there was paperwork and rustling and doctors and nurses, and then Adam was in a bed and a doctor was talking about taking him into surgery in the morning. I couldn't process any of it because he was home and we were going to spend the rest of our lives together just like we had planned. I'd never felt a glee this pure. It was a high I didn't know a human could experience. At last, when we were alone, I finally noticed how gaunt and gray Adam looked, the exhaustion in his eyes, the new lines in his face. I ran my hand along his sunken cheek. "Honey," I said, "what happened to you?" He shook his head. "Sloane, I'm alive. One of my men lost his life. An innocent kid lost his." I had never, in all his deployments, seen my husband this raw, this vulnerable. I felt myself bristle when he said, "innocent kid." "What do you mean?" I whispered, my stomach already turning, not truly wanting to know the answer.
"A 17-year-old kid, one of the sons."
He trailed off, and I waited patiently.
"He helped us escape,"
he said, his eyes filling with tears.
"What?"
I asked, truly stunned. "I thought it was a Delta Force operation." Adam bit his lip.
"Well, it was, technically, and thank God. If they hadn't been on their way, we'd all be dead, no question."
He swallowed hard, and I took his hand, rubbing it. He teared up and said,
"I'm sorry."
I kissed his forehead.
"Don't be sorry. There's nothing to be sorry about."
"If we just waited 10 more minutes."
I wasn't surprised by his emotion necessarily, but it unnerved me all the same. I had never seen him like this.
"This brave little kid got us out."
He looked around and continued.
"If we had just waited, if we had just been patient, that kid would still be alive. His father wouldn't have killed him for being a traitor."
I put my hand to my mouth. I felt sick, sicker than sick. But my job here was to soothe my husband.
"You don't know that, Adam."
He nodded, tears in his eyes.
"I saw him fall. And it will haunt me forever. I can't help but feel like it was my fault."
I remembered the drone footage. The man running and falling. That wasn't a man at all. He was a child. a teenager, a son. I wondered if his mother was grieving, if she was alone in her grief. "It's not your fault, Adam," I said. "It was God's plan. We can't control it."
"It was a sucky plan," he said under his breath.
"Adam," I scolded.
"I thought we were all dead, Sloane. I swear I did. And I wanted to stay alive and be there for you and the boys, but I knew I'd rather be dead than spend another second in that hellhole."
He cleared his throat.
I felt the vibration even before I heard it. I thought I was hallucinating, but then I started to hear it and I knew it was real.
He paused.
I looked up and there it was, a Black Hawk. We were being shot at and running for our lives, but when I saw it, I knew we were saved.
My heart was pounding in my chest now, torn between the terror that my husband had nearly died and the swelling pride that God had saved him. I knew there had to be a great purpose behind that moment. Adam was here for a reason.
"They saved me, Sloane. They saved us all. I wouldn't be here."
He rubbed his chin and kind of half-smiled.
"Those guys from the 160th and Delta Force are such badasses."
I laughed. "They have great hair, too." Members of Delta Force needed to blend in with their surroundings and, as such, generally had longer hair and beards. They stuck out like sore thumbs when compared to the clean-shaven faces and clipped heads on post. "I should make them cookies." He looked up at me and really smiled now, and it was as if the filter of those negative memories was washed away and he was seeing me with fresh eyes. I leaned down and kissed him, remembering how he used to sweep me up in his arms and carry me up the stairs. I considered that that was a thing of the past. But life is one big series of surprises, inconveniences, and things not working out like you thought they would. And so we press on. We choose to fight into another day. That's what Adam and I would do.
"I love you," he said. "Have I said that? I love you so much. You kept me alive, Sloane. I fought through every day for you."
I nodded. "I love you too. I can't believe you're here." I paused and I could feel the tears in my throat. "But you're going to leave again. You're going to be deployed again and leave me." He tucked my hair behind my ears and shook his head.
"Babe, this leg healed enough on its own that I can hobble on it, but even after the surgery, I will never be able to be back out in the field."
"I shouldn't be happy about that," I said, feeling terribly guilty. I didn't want my husband to have a terrible injury that would never heal just to have him stay home with me, but truthfully, I'd take it. "I'm really sorry." Then there was silence. I was used to this. I remembered it well. After a deployment, it took a few weeks for Adam and me to get back in our groove. He didn't want to talk about where he'd been or what had happened. I didn't want to talk about anything else because nothing would possibly compare to what he was dealing with. I understood he was trying to protect me and, in some ways, was grateful for what he didn't say. I couldn't imagine how I would feel if I knew what he had been through when he was gone, but there was no doubt that his other life I knew nothing about created a bit of distance between us. Eventually, as the days wore on, we would fall back into our rhythm. He would wake up early and work out before the kids got up. We would all have breakfast together. These small moments would weave themselves together in the way of a beautiful yet simple tapestry. "Today," I said, "Caroline and James bought a house in Peachtree while you were away. She said we can live there as long as we'd like." Adam smiled and shook his head.
"Sloane, we can't live in their house."
I understood where he was coming from, but in my eyes it wasn't even a question. Caroline was my sister. I'd always thought of what was mine as ours. Emerson's, Caroline's, and mine. We were as good as the same person. Granted, Caroline had a lot more of it to give than I did, but that didn't mean that, in her heart, she felt any differently. She's going to move over with the kids and Emerson into Mom's guest house. James has to go back to the city, but she wants to stay in Peachtree a little longer. Adam nodded. Then he wrapped his arms around me and held me there for a long time. I finally got the nerve to whisper. Tom?
He made it. Adam whispered back. I don't know if they will be able to save his left arm, but he made it.
I was dually sad and relieved. I couldn't wait to call Mary Ann. Adam cleared his throat.
So, fill me in, he said. What's been happening since I've been gone?
Oh, nothing much, I said, fluffing his pillow. Just the usual. James had an affair and was on TV with his girlfriend, who Emmy then played in a movie. She is back together with her high school boyfriend and may have aplastic anemia or something equally as horrible, but Mom doesn't know. Mom is back together with her first love. Grammy died. With a very straight face, Adam nodded and said,
You're right. Nothing out of the ordinary.
Then we both laughed with everything we had inside of us, with the happiness that Adam was home, the knowledge that our little world was coming back together, and the elation that we were us again. I thought about all I had to catch Adam up on. It was time to come clean about the credit cards, brag a little about my paintings, and tell him about Mother's morning out. But there will be time for that. Thankfully, joyfully, there would be time. 10 days later, we were settling into a routine. Caroline and James's house had been the perfect place to come home to. Adam was undergoing physical therapy and struggling, not just physically, but mentally. But I'd been prepared for this. Even so, it terrified me when Adam woke up in the middle of the night ranting that he had to go back there and get his men. He cried almost daily for the friend he'd lost, lamented that he was the leader, that he should have been the one that died. There were times when I noticed the dullness in his eyes, the pain behind them, the haunted look. It scared me, but it made me strong, too. As they had always been, Adam's problems were my problems. We were married. After what I had been through over the past few months, I could handle being in charge now. I could take care of Adam. And, amidst the pain and suffering, there were still moments of normalcy between us, and, better yet, glimpses of the great love we had always shared. As I served breakfast that morning, Adam, already sitting at the head of the table, he scooped me into his lap and kissed me.
It's strange, he said, how one minute I can feel like everything is completely meaningless, how all that matters is what's over there, and how this life we lead is so trite and insignificant, and then the next moment I see you and think everything that matters is these small things, these eggs and strawberries, the stories we read to the boys.
I smiled at him. I didn't understand. I never would, but I tried and would continue to. It wasn't the perfectly choreographed moment I had planned, but it somehow felt right. Adam, I said. Speaking of the meaning of life, I paused, kissed him, and added, What would you think about my going back to work, showing my art, and continuing to help Mom at the store? He didn't say anything, so I kept going. I mean, I know I'm an army wife, and my role is to take care of my family. Adam cut me off. He pulled me closer.
Sloan, you're not just an army wife. You are my wife. You are the most perfect woman in the world. Your role is what makes you happy. Nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah? I asked, swallowing hard. He looked at me almost sadly, as though I had underestimated him in some way.
Babe, yes, of course. I miss your art. Nothing would make me happier than to see you go back to it.
Really? I could feel the tears in my eyes, and it wasn't until I felt them that I realized how much this truly meant to me. Adam wiped my tears and laughed.
Sloan, are you serious?
He shifted. I want you to be you. I fell in love with you and all your complexity. My favorite thing about you is how you keep surprising me. As the boys ran to the table, I thought my heart would burst.
Bacon!
AJ practically sang. The boys were beside themselves to have their daddy home. I stood up just in time for Taylor and AJ to crash into Adam, and there was no other way to describe it. Life was as it should be. Life was perfect. Well, perfect, except we were still waiting for test results from Emerson's New York doctor's visit. We were still waiting to find out what exactly was wrong with her. The fact that Mom still didn't know anything about her illness gnawed at me, perhaps more than it should have. But I couldn't imagine something being wrong with one of my children and having everyone keep that from me. Later that morning, Mom came to get the boys for a little Gransley time, and Adam's physical therapist arrived. I was attempting to fold laundry and trying to ignore my husband's pained groans and muffled screams. Afterward, Adam lay down for a nap. He was still regaining his strength, slowly, day by day. I sat down to open the mail and pay the bills, but the way the sun was glinting off the water inspired me so much that I couldn't concentrate. I had to paint. It felt more satisfying than it had in some time. This was a piece that would make someone else happy. This was a painting I would sell. 2 hours later, I walked back into Mom's house, which was buzzing with activity. Mom was in the kitchen making snacks. Vivi, who was home from camp, was helping AJ with a particularly intensive car-building project. And Taylor was napping upstairs in his old room. It was a calm, yet electric time. I hugged Caroline, who was flipping through product photos on her computer, shopping for Mom's store. It is beyond sweet of you to let us stay at your house. We can never repay you. Caroline and I both looked at Mom. She rolled her eyes. Yes, yes, she said. What a gift that someone would just take you in off the street. We all laughed. Caroline put her arm around Mom. I missed Mommy Dearest's guest house. It's quite fabulous. I'm happy to be living there again. She paused and whispered so Vivi couldn't hear. And you won't believe it, but I kind of miss James. Mom whispered, so do I. We all laughed. Jack walked through the door and kissed Mom on the cheek. We all made gagging noises, but really it was sweet. She was so starry-eyed over him that she could hardly put one foot in front of the other. I'm glad you're here, Jack, I said. The painter's finished, and Caroline and I volunteered to put your house back together for our darling mother. You two are peaches, she said, grinning. Have I told you what they are making me pay them per hour? She asked Jack, eyebrow raised. I'll help you move the furniture, Jack said. I put my hand up to stop him. I needed Caroline to myself to talk about the thing that had been gnawing at me for almost 2 weeks. No, no, it's all on sliders. I paused and said, plus that hourly rate thing. As we closed the back door, Caroline said, what's going on? I bit my lip. I've been thinking about some things, and I want your opinion. She nodded, and I realized she was wearing 6-inch wedges. She might not have been the best choice for furniture moving. You know the man on the beach that day, who was fighting with Mom? I asked. You mean when we were kids? I nodded. Yeah, she said. What about it? It was Jack. Caroline stopped cold between the two houses. Keep walking, I scolded. You'll look suspicious. I opened the back door and Caroline said, how do you know that? I shrugged. I have such a clear memory of it. When Mom and Jack were on the plane, the light hit his hair a certain way. Then it dawned on me it was him. Caroline nodded.
I was shocked that she didn't argue with me, but she probably knew I wouldn't bring this up unless I was sure. Okay, so what does that mean? What would Mom and Jack possibly have been fighting about on a beach when we were little girls? She gasped. You don't think they were having an affair or something, do you? I shook my head. Don't be ridiculous. Mom would never do something like that. Caroline scrunched up her face. Yeah, she's pretty vanilla. So what then? That's what I've been trying to figure out, I said. So a few weeks ago, I was in the store, and I said something about getting my artistic talent from my father, and Jack said, no, you definitely got that from your mother. Caroline opened Jack's refrigerator, removing a smart water and handing me one, too. So what? He was complimenting Mom. We just eat out of Jack's fridge now, too? I asked. Why not? Caroline said. At the rate things are moving between them, I think it's safe to say he's our almost daddy. Then she dropped her water on the floor, her hand frozen in midair. You think Jack said that because he's our sperm donor and he knows he doesn't have any artistic talent? She leaned over and picked up the bottle, not even the slightest bend in her knees. I was so envious I could barely touch my shins. I mean, it's kind of a stretch, I shrugged. I don't know, I'm just wondering. And she didn't want to date him. Caroline nodded her head furiously. Then she swallowed and said, and you overheard her telling him she had so much to lose if they were together. We are a lot to lose, I said. My head was spinning now. I felt totally sure Caroline was going to talk me out of this and tell me I was insane. Then I could put this out of my mind as a series of odd coincidences. But now that Caroline thought what I thought, my mind was racing. What did this mean? Do you honestly think he's our father? She walked into the living room, where all the furniture was covered with sheets and pushed to the center of the room. Let's get this moved. Oh, right, I said. Then I added, how would we feel about it? I feel kind of weird, Caroline said. Although, strangely better than if my father was a random test tube, which is how I've always imagined it. How do you feel? I don't know. Maybe we're just trying to come to terms with Mom dating again, a new man being in her life, so we're projecting all these feelings onto him. I nodded, gesturing to a large secretary that had to be moved. Thankfully, it was on sliders. Caroline obviously didn't know that, because as I started sliding, she started lifting. Three drawers rushed out of their slots and crashed onto the floor, their contents dispersing wildly throughout the room. Nice, I said. One priceless antique, totally ruined. Caroline pulled the sheet off and said, this thing made it over on a ship from England like 200 years ago. Surely it can take a little bump. I knelt down to pick up the drawers and stopped cold. Heat rose through my body. Caroline wasn't moving either. She was flipping through a stack of pictures in her hand. But when she looked up at me and what I had in my hands, she gasped. She handed me the pictures and I handed her the bag. Tears sprung to my eyes, but I wasn't sure why. The pictures were of us. Caroline and me, and then Caroline, Emerson, and me. Each had the date on the back in Mom's handwriting. They could be Christmas card pictures, I said, hesitantly, knowing they weren't Christmas card pictures. Maybe he's really organized about them. She opened the pink bag that had our monograms on it and handed me a fairy stone. I looked up at my sister and I thought of Grandpop and his words of encouragement to us that day. I guess he needed them more than we did, I whispered. The door slammed shut and Caroline and I got the photos and stones put away just as Jack appeared in the doorway. As if he were reading our energy, Jack seemed flustered. Everything okay? He asked. I looked at Caroline, and she looked at me, but neither of us said a word. I could feel the heat in my face and my racing heart. Could Jack be our father? I couldn't ask. The look on Caroline's face told me she couldn't either. I looked at her again, helplessly, urging her without words to take control like she always did. I could sense Jack was about to say something when I heard from the backyard, "Sloane! Caroline! Come quick!" I wasn't sure I could make my feet move, but when Caroline grabbed my hand, I did. "Do you think?" I asked her when we were back outside in the yard. She shrugged. "I mean, I don't know. Let's not read too much into this, okay?" All these years, I had wondered who my biological father was, but now that the truth was potentially right in front of me, I wasn't sure I was ready for it. As we reached the front porch, I looked out over the sparkling water, the sun setting hot and vibrant, warming our little patch of earth. Emerson looked as if she were about to burst wide open as she called, "Mom, hurry up, get out here!" I looked at Caroline again, and I wondered if we had done the wrong thing in walking away, if we should have stayed and learned the truth. But maybe it didn't matter. What would it change, really? I wondered again if we should have asked Jack about our suspicions. I felt in my heart that he wouldn't lie to us. I felt in my heart that we were connected more deeply than our brief encounters would allow. And I had to admit that connection, that voice in my head that I recognized that I relied on and trusted Jack far more than was reasonable, was something I had been ignoring for a long time. Caroline squeezed my hand, and I wonder if she felt that with Jack, too. I squeezed back, but I didn't say a thing. And I realized, when it comes to matters of the heart, when it comes to love, no matter what form that takes, sometimes there really are no words. Sometimes the right answer, the only answer, the truth, is something you have to feel.
38. The Beauty of the Silence. Ansley. For one of the first times in months, I was blessedly, silently all alone. Emerson had gone out with Mark. Caroline and Sloane were next door moving Jack's furniture, and he had gone over to see if he could help. I sat down in one of the Louis ghost chairs around the antique wood dining room table in front of the orchard, as we had affectionately nicknamed the spot where all our Macs generally ended up every day. I sat down to check my email, and Biscuit jumped in my lap. "Hi there, little girl," I said, scratching behind her ears. "I think we made it. I think we're all going to be okay." I'm not sure if dogs can smile, but I'm pretty sure she did. I clicked on my inbox, absent-mindedly deleting emails from Moda Operandi, Vogue.com, Jet Setter. How did I get signed up for all these email lists? I paused my cursor over one labeled Test Results. I almost deleted it, assuming it was spam, but I clicked instead. "Dear Emerson, I have received your test results, and I'd like to set up a phone call to discuss. If you would prefer, I can see you in the office, but I believe you were flying back to Georgia when I saw you last. Please call the office to schedule. My best, Dr. Douglas Thomas, Park Avenue Hematology and Oncology." I was paralyzed by panic. This was not, in fact, my MacBook Pro. It was Emerson's. And something was seriously wrong with my child. Oncology? Dear Lord, did she have cancer? I was about to begin a full spiral when I realized I could just ask her, which was what I was about to do when I heard Emerson calling Sloane and Caroline. And then I heard her calling me. I stormed outside, about to give her a piece of my mind, but when I opened the door, Biscuit under my arm, I sensed this wasn't the right moment. Emerson was standing to the right of the doorway, Mark's arm around her. They were both grinning like they used to when they found out they were getting a hurricane day off from school. Caroline and Sloan were across from me, close enough to the steps that I wanted to pull them back so they didn't fall. Emerson squealed, "We're engaged," holding her hand out to me before I could launch into my interrogation. My eyes widened. I knew she liked Mark, but engaged? Now I had an entirely new set of questions. I grabbed her hand and said, "Oh my gosh, Emerson!" Caroline was jumping up and down, hugging Mark, and Sloane was smiling at me, her face mirroring the shock I felt. But I reasoned Mark and Emerson had known each other their entire lives. If they wanted to marry each other, then nothing could thrill me more. A tingle of glee that maybe Emerson would move to Peachtree Bluff with Mark started in the tip of my toes. Jack walked out his front door, and I smiled, realizing that I might get to have this moment with him. I smiled because I could finally admit I might like to have this moment with him. There were so many questions, but I couldn't ask them. I gazed at Emerson's jubilant face. She didn't look sick. She couldn't be sick. There had to be a simple explanation for her doctor visit. I had struggled with low iron in my 20s. It was probably nothing more than that. I looked out at Starlight Island as if I could will my late parents to help me and give us all a moment of calm. As the water rushed by, making its way to another part of the world, I suddenly realized what a tiny part I was in the grand scheme of a greater whole. And I had a thought that soothed me. We are all destined to be forgotten. Maybe not the 1% of the 1% who do something earth-shaking, like discovering electricity or becoming queen. But the rest of us will be gone. And by the time our children are gone, and most certainly our grandchildren, no one will remember we even existed. I looked over at Starlight Island again, and I didn't feel that pang in my gut, that devastation around my heart, with the remembrance that my parents were gone. Instead, I looked across into the dusky night, where the moon was beginning to rise on my favorite fragment of the world. And, despite the turmoil swirling in my mind, I felt at peace. The girls, who were chattering and squealing, ran inside as Jack walked out the front door and wordlessly squeezed my shoulders. He pulled me closer to him, protectively. I was grateful for a man who understood my quiet, who knew when all I needed was his presence beside me. As I watched the wild horses graze, I realized maybe it didn't matter that we were all destined to be forgotten. Maybe all that mattered was what we did while we were here, how well we lived, how much we loved, how hard we tried with all our might to care for the ones around us. I turned to kiss Jack. Instead of living for tomorrow and worrying what the future would hold, I had to live for today. I would never discover the telephone, create a masterpiece that would change the world, or write a piece of legislation that would be remembered for years to come. But I would love my family and fight for them until the day I died. I may not be put in some hall of great women, but that was my purpose in life. And tonight, with the man I had loved for a lifetime beside me, and the breeze in my favorite place in the world rustling in the trees, that was good enough for me. As he held me close, my heart beating in time to his, I knew that whenever we decided to tell the girls Jack was their father, they might not understand. It would probably take time for them to adjust to this new reality. I wasn't even sure what I would say. But sometimes the words don't matter, I realized as I stood with Jack, as he stood with me, saying nothing but telling me everything I would ever need to know. I thought of my parents again, finally resting across the water from me. Of the seeds on Kimmy's